This is Dissecting Dragons, a speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Hello, and welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeleine Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, Remus Werewolf McWerewolf Lupin, the importance of character names in speculative fiction.
Now, Jules had a...
I had a Shakespeare quote, but, you know, Madeleine kind of shat all over that one. So you guys got the pun.
Yeah, she had a proper title, and I thought, no, let's bring in Lupin Werewolf McWerewolf with the title, and thus here we are. I'm not sorry.
Of course you're not sorry.
Now, Jules, this episode was your idea. So as always, I'm just going to let you...
ramble on about
it. Yep, off you go.
It's a light episode. Basically, we've done a few fairly sort of heavy ones recently. So a lighter one, looking at character names. And I've seen something fairly recently whereby I think it was a guy who basically teaches writing fiction. I'm not sure how effective he is based on this essay, but anyway, he was saying that you needn't waste a lot of time coming up with character names. Come up with something that readers will remember. Don't put apostrophes in weird places like Anne McCaffrey.
Don't tell me what to do. I'll do what I want.
Yeah, don't come up with anything really exotic sounding or anything really, you know, foreign sounding even. And that's when I started to get annoyed with him. And he said, and don't worry about what the character name means because your readers do not give a shit. And I'm like, you know what? I don't care if my readers don't give a shit. I will probably pick a character name that's right and has a name meaning that means something to me because it pleases me to do so, and I'm writing the sorting book, so you can just get stuffed. Thank you very much.
Also, clearly he's never met serious fans. Like, no. Come on, fan theories. Like, the things I see based on the, you know, the aesthetic posts that you see with the name meanings. I mean, I'm always looking up name meanings as well in books, and I'm like, oh, this adds a whole new level to this, even if it's like totally random.
Exactly.
I'm obsessed with names.
It's something that if it's a series of books I really like, then I will go and find out the name meanings. And it's, I don't necessarily even, you know, I've never needed, you know, spelt out for me or anything. I think the first time I did it was with the Deptford Mice series, and I was just, you know, so in love with that series as a sort of, you know, 12-year-old that I wanted to know what the character names meant, and it did. It added an extra dimension for me, even though I'm not sure Robin Jarvis actually was that bothered about the name meanings meaning something, as in they might have meant something to him, but...
Yeah.
Anyway, so it got me thinking that there are lots of authors who actually do seem to completely disregard this supposed rule about character names and either take great delight in basically giving you the entire character encapsulated in their name or adding in secrets in the form of the character name. And some are more subtle than others.
I do like it. It's I'm always of the opinion that looking further into a book should bring you rewards. There should be several levels to a book, several layers, so that people who are going back to it will always find little bits and bobs. So you can do that with foreshadowing, you can do that with all sorts of little techniques.
Yeah.
And names are a big part of that. Having small names which give clues are just... people love it. They get really furious because they're like, oh my god. But at the same time, you know, you love it. And sometimes it is blindingly obvious. Yet, we still love it.
Yeah. Yeah, no, and it's great. I suppose, considering the title, we should probably start with Harry Potter just because it's a...
We should.
It's a good kicking off place.
Yeah, so this is actually a running joke within the Harry Potter fandom that it's meant to be a twist that Lupin is a werewolf when his name is Remus
I think the thing is, when it Harry Potter actually inspired a lot of reading into, Greek and Roman mythology,
Yeah.
because that's where J.K. Rowling obviously took it from.
Yeah.
And I don't think necessarily when it came out in the early 90s that a lot of people were quite as into it if they weren't like nerdy people like me. So yes, I
Yeah.
saw it straight away, but that was only because I'd always had an interest, whereas I think she kicked off a lot of interest in that direction. And this was pre-Percy Jackson, wasn't it, as well?
It was, and she did, and to be honest, this wasn't, it's not a bad thing. It wasn't obvious. Like I didn't, when I first read it, I didn't see it coming, at least not from the name. And yet afterwards you're like, his name is literally Wolf Wolf. It's ridiculous. It's like, how could you possibly know I was a werewolf? Well, your parents had really sick sense of humor.
Considering he didn't start off as a werewolf either, it's not like from a werewolf family. It's a case of, well, we think this might be your fate, son.
Exactly. That, or he did have a different name and then he got bit and his mother was like, well, at the least we can stop calling you Snootyton. We shall call you Lupin instead. So yeah, yes, he did come from a peculiar family in that regard. And yeah, it's a dead giveaway. And it is almost, well, it isn't almost, it's a joke. It literally is a joke within the fandom that his name is Wolf Wolf. And it is a joke because, yeah, somehow his parents called him Wolf Wolf before he became a werewolf. And it's, yeah, highly improbable. The only kind of thing that happens in fiction, and some people would argue, oh, that's really, it really sort of breaks kind of the concentration for me. It just feels a bit too much, but I really liked it, and especially for a children's book. This is the other thing. Every time we're critical of Harry Potter, we must remember it's a children's book.
Yeah.
So having little fun conventions like that isn't a bad thing. So yeah, I liked having that. It seems to me there were other little name games in the books as well.
Yeah, I mean, Sirius Black for a start, Sirius the dog star.
Though, and yeah, to be honest though, it could be that he was the dog star and therefore that he was drawn to dogs and that's why he became the dog Animagus. So it's a little less far-fetched than Werewolf McWerewolf. But at the same time, yeah, they did do all these fun little things. The other thing to consider is, of course, that all of the names of the Weasleys are kind of based off of Arthurian knights,
Yeah.
which was quite nice. So Ginny, Guinevere, Percy, Percival, Bill, William, Charlie, I did see this written out properly, and yeah, there are the sort of little links to kind of kings and stuff like that, and that's where the names come from,
Yeah, I mean,
which does make sense.
she obviously liked the more old-fashioned names. There's no character in the Harry Potter universe that I'm aware of who is called Chardonnay, for example, and I'm thankful for that.
Yeah.
And I like some of the older names as well. The ones, I mean, part of it is tapping into the old British school system, the old British boarding school, where if you think back to Enid Blyton and everything, you would have characters called Jean and Joan, etc.
Yeah, you would. And also the whole using the surnames thing. And they're very, very English sounding names, actually. Weasley, Potter, Malfoy,
Yeah, Malfoy's a bit sort of sounds like it should be Norman French, really.
even. Yeah. Well, yeah, I think it. Yeah, but you are. Not to be, I think you are kind of meant to assume that they are of, their aristocratic blood. So having kind of, yeah, that Norman-esque sounding name
Yeah.
Whereas Potter sounds like a very common English name.
Well, yeah, from an occupation.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, I quite liked that. I quite liked the way that names were done in the Harry Potter universe. The names were quite weird, though.
Yeah, well, I mean, once you get past like the third book, she really sort of pulls the stops out, and you get things like Xenophilius. And it's like you're really dredging, the depths of Greek mythology and things here with that. But I like it because Xenophilius sort of translated means love of the strange.
Yeah. And you know what Dumbledore means?
Bumblebee. It's a
Yes.
Dorsetshire word.
Yeah. Which I thought was actually kind of sweet.
And Albus obviously meaning white.
Yes. So white Bumblebee. Because the thing is, I think she kind of came up with the name Dumbledore before she knew the sheer depths that he was going to go to.
Yeah, possibly. And there's something quite comfortable and cozy about a bumblebee, as long as it's not being stung at the time.
Yeah.
That's a very English country childhood sort of feeling.
Yeah.
Hearing a droning bumblebee. Anyway. So, yeah, I mean, this is something that authors do, and they don't just do it with character names. They use words and phrases and references to books and films and other bits of culture that their readers will be familiar with in order to create chains of association. And if you're skillful in the way that you do it, you can actually conjure up like a second and third picture behind the main picture that reinforces the first picture.
Yeah.
This is something that actually, I'm going off on a slight tangent here, but Jane Austen did this really, really well. And a lot of us don't actually realise it reading her books today. But the references she uses in things like Mansfield Park, for example, tell you that that entire book, while it takes place in an English country estate, Mansfield Park, is the entire book is about human bondage and slavery. It is literally a really quite scathing takedown of the English church and the fact that it was still hand in hand with slavery at the time.
Yeah, which they actually do explore in some of the at least one of the more recent adaptations, the film adaptations. They really did bring out those themes, bring those themes forward. But how? But can you explain a little bit further how that's shown in the book with the names?
Yeah, a little bit. It's not so much the character names themselves, not in Mansfield Park, but if there's obviously there's Fanny, who's the daughter of the sister who marries quite below her station, and she as one of like 10 children, her richer relations sort of take her in along with their own children. And
Yeah.
that was common practice. It was common practice to say, oh well, we don't have very many children, let's take in one of our relatives as well. Or if
Yeah.
you were childless, you might take in one of your nieces or nephews and raise them as your own. And there were no formal adoption papers or anything, or not until they reached sort of their majority. But at that point, then they would become your heir, and they were your son or your daughter or whatever.
Yeah.
So, and that was the way it was done. There wasn't anything particularly sinister about that. But in Fanny's case, she's always made to feel like the poor relation living in this rich house. So there's that instance. She's treated from the get-go as a sort of underservant to all of her better-off relations. She's kind of disregarded, and she's treated well. She's given a better quality of life, but at the same time, she's constantly aware of her inferiority.
Yeah.
Her uncle, who is obviously kind enough to her in many respects, his fortune comes from slavery, and it is talked about quite candidly. And the fact that Fanny's not actually on board with the whole thing is talked about quite candidly. And her
Yeah.
cousin Edmund says you ought to have spoken to him about it because he would have been interested in your views, etc., etc. And then they double down on this theme because when the story really starts kicking off and the Crawfords turn up, the Crawfords are quite badly behaved in many ways by the terms of the society at the time, and they're encouraging the children of the house. I say children, but they're adults by this point, in some quite bad behaviour. One of which is to put on plays and things and do readings of texts that aren't really considered appropriate for young people to be reading aloud from. Jane Austen could have chosen anything, but she chose things like Othello, and she chose I can't remember, but it's one of the novels by Aphra Behn, you know, the yeah. female playwright from Shakespearean era,
mm-hmm.
About, you know, a slave who defies his master, etc. It'll come back to me, I expect. It's another O word. It's gone right out of my head, and various other things, and it's all in the text there. And then there is one point where her brother gives her a little chain for her birthday because she's coming of age. She's 18,
yeah,
and they decide to throw a birthday party where she's literally sort of coming out, as it were, in society, yeah. not coming out as we would understand it today.
Yeah,
and her cousin gives her a little cross. And she thinks, oh, that would be just the thing to go on the chain my brother's given me. And there is one sentence mm-hmm. where it's very, you know, it's quite even heavy-handed for Jane Austen, where she's saying, and all it wanted was but a moment to unite the chain and the cross.
Yeah.
And it, after everything else that had come before it, this is a clear case of the church endorses this behaviour. The church endorses and takes a lot of money from plantations and slavery. And then it's doubled down on again in following chapters. So that's what I mean about chains of association, basically.
It's like, the other thing is that, sorry, we're going on a slight, we are going on a slight tangent here talking about it. But the other thing that really adds to that is that she's taken away from home. And then when she is returned home, she doesn't quite fit in anymore.
No, exactly. And it is that same sense of displacement.
Yeah.
Added to which, the whole thing being about humans used as a physical resource, but in various different ways, there's a nasty sexual undertone there as well. There is the fact that Fanny is made intensely uncomfortable by her uncle commenting on her appearance and her dress and her figure.
Mm.
And the fact that of all Jane Austen's heroines, Fanny is the only one who has short cropped hair. Which yeah. doesn't show up in a lot of the films, but it's almost like she's trying to disguise herself and look less like a woman.
Yeah.
So there's that in there as well. And of course, with slavery, the slaves were very often raped, both male and female. So Jane Austen really wasn't pulling her punches there.
Yeah, no.
She was an intensely political writer, and we think... In general, I think nowadays, because we don't understand these chains of association, because we just don't have these works in our vernacular, as it were, that she just wrote light romances. And the reality is, no, she wrote stuff in code that she could have been put in prison for.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And using names is actually a really, really good way of doing that. Because historically, yeah, using names would also allow you to discuss things through sheer change of name, would allow you to discuss things which otherwise would not be permitted at all.
Yeah, definitely. And she certainly did use character names to do it as well. If you take Pride and Prejudice, it's very noticeable that the main upper class people that we are treated to,
mm-hmm.
Lady Catherine de Bourgh and Mr. Darcy, that they're French-sounding names. And at the time, she's referencing the fact that the French Revolution is going on. That yeah. The entire book, Pride and Prejudice, is a demand for more equality between, you know, between the various levels of the gentry, but also respect and equality between the lower classes of society and the upper ones, because you're not always going to be on the top, basically.
Yeah. And that is that's a very small thing, but it is a very prevalent thing, which some people kind of pick up on and put into adaptations now. But I do think that they are kind of lost a little bit because of kind of the period in which they're being drawn from. Whereas, you know, there are other associations that you might see now, which are based on popular kind of fiction, which you would then be able to recognise instantly. For instance, calling someone Arthur.
Yeah.
it immediately kind of brings on certain connotations of kingliness, for instance, but also possibly connotations from not so much from the legends, but also probably from films that we've seen now. And what if I say the name Arthur, what do you think of, Jules?
Well, I mean, you there's a couple of levels here because I suppose initially I think of, King Arthur, the myths, but then I also think of like the slight Celtic translation of it. And then my third one is I think of Arthur Dent, who is the complete juxtaposition of the whole King Arthur thing.
Exactly. You can either have Arthur as the complete straight guy, if you know what I mean, as a slightly boring guy, because you get characters called Arthur who fulfill that role. And that's the other thing about names, is that through a name, you can tell what a whole character is from what we expect of that name.
Yeah.
And names are often used like that in order to sort of really understand who we're going to be sort of dealing with. I mean, if you get introduced to a character like Draco Malfoy, you kind of already know he's going to be an antagonist.
Yeah, basically.
And this is in a world which is full of really weird, bloody names.
It is.
Severus Snape. I mean, come on.
I'm afraid it's made the name Snape just sort of stick in my head. There's a company near where I work. I think it's called Snape's Fittings and Carpentry. And there's a little purple van that goes round with Snape's written on the side. And I always have a giggle when I see it in the morning because obviously I'm thinking, well, Snape's gone away from Defence Against the Dark Arts. So I can't help it because it's made the name stick.
I think the other thing is, and you brought this up with Jane Austen, is the use of names which sound foreign
Yeah.
and how actually they've been used, particularly historically, and even in modern fiction as well, to kind of tell us who we're going to be dealing with. And there is racism definitely involved. I mean, you will for a time, Jewish sounding names, they were usually antagonists.
Yeah.
You tend to find them within certain areas. So a greedy Jewish banker would be, you'd have a greedy Jewish banker who'd never be said to be Jewish, but he'd have a Jewish sounding name, and therefore there was an association, and
Yeah.
you'd see this in fiction in the same way that you'd find very sort of common names for very for people who were stupid in fiction as well.
Yeah, definitely. Another good example, moving back from the sort of 18th century to the 19th, is Charles Dickens.
Yes.
And he was well known for the way he formed names. For example, Uriah Heep. Even if you're kind of like, I don't know what that name means, you immediately get this image of this sort of hunched, obsequious character who's possibly not entirely clean and up to no good. And then things like other 19th century novelists did as well. Thinking of Wilkie Collins with his The Woman in White, and you've got Laura Fairlie, for example, a Walter Hartwright. It's like, well, I guess he's the hero of that piece then. And Count Fosco, well, Fosco, it's foreign and he's clearly up to no good and he's in a position of power. No doubt he's an antagonist.
Yeah. I mean, you also get it in things like Star Wars, for instance. I mean,
Really hammered home in Star Wars.
it's really hammered home. Like, it's funny because, of course, Luke Skywalker, his name was initially going to be, I think it was going to be Star Killer or
Yeah.
something along those lines. And then they just went, oh no, we'll just call the thing the Death Star instead.
Yeah.
And yeah, you can understand why they didn't go for Star Killer. They went for Skywalker.
Yeah,
And
an explorer, not a murderer kind of
yeah,
thing.
exactly. And then you get Han Solo. His name is literally Solo, and he's his whole thing. He's the loner. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's kind of like you've become a parody of yourself and you don't even realize it.
So,
in Roald Dahl as well, I'm thinking of Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, you've got Violet Budgerigar. So
yeah.
Someone who chatters a lot and doesn't really make a lot of sense, and yet she literally turns into a blueberry as well, because she chatters and hasn't actually paid any attention. And someone, Mike TV, his big thing is he watches TV.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, Roald Dahl wasn't joking around. He was being pretty explicit in what he was trying to say.
And Veruca Salt. Veruca? Seriously, who would call their child Veruca? And she is a little wart as well.
Yeah. So yeah, we have all these examples. And then sometimes the names are less obvious. And I've been watching a series recently, and by recently I mean I watched it all yesterday. And it's a new series on Netflix called The Dragon Prince.
Right.
I do recommend it. Its animation style's a bit weird and takes a little bit of getting used to. It feels like gameplay rather than an animated style, but it's made by some of the same people who made Avatar. And it's pretty revolutionary in that there's a deaf character in it who signs.
Cool.
And I thought, that's really cool. And here's the kicker, right? There are people of colour, right, in this animation. There are people of colour. And they're voiced by people of colour.
Awesome.
I know. Shock, gasp, who thought it? And I was just thinking, like, oh yeah, this is nice. Da-da-da-da-da. Now wait a second. And I started looking at some of the names. And some of them are a bit on the nose. For instance, you meet at the beginning the king, who's called King Harrow.
Yep.
Now, Harrow is obviously comes from, you know, to harrow, which is it's about farming, and it's basically what you do when you're breaking up the earth so that you can plant the new harvest, right? And the premise right at the beginning of the series is that King Harrow is going to be murdered, and he knows he is. The assassins are coming for him. And he's trying to hide his two young sons. One of them is his son, one of them is adopted, so far as we can tell. And he's trying to hide them, and he's trying to do what's best for his kingdom. And I thought, and you called him Harrow. You know, the messy process that he's going through, in which he's accepting his fate because he knows mistakes have been made. But that kind of messy process in order to plant new seeds so that life can flourish.
Yeah.
So I thought, okay, all right, so we've got Harrow. So then I thought, let me look at kind of some of the others. So the two princes, the youngest one is called Ezrin. Closest I can come to that is obviously the name Ezra, which means honor in the family. It can also mean protector. And strong and beautiful, and he's that just seems like a very fitting name for a crown prince, you know?
Yeah.
And also one thing about Ezrin is that he is carrying, and I don't want to give too much away, but he's carrying something very important through the entire series. He's the one who's taking care of it. So he is this protector figure. So I thought, okay, that's really, really quite nice. And then there's another name which means protector, which is the Rayla. Rayla is one of the Moonshadow Elves. She's one of the assassins who's come to kill the king. And she ends up kind of falling in with Callum and Ezrin, who are the two princes. And she's the one who's protecting them the entire time. So obviously her name means protector. And then Callum, and this was the bit that got me. Callum comes from Colombia, and it means dove prince.
Oh yeah, I knew that.
Yeah. Now this is funny. This is funny Because in a family of people of colour, he's the only white one because he's clearly adopted.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's known that he's adopted. He's the prince as well, but he's not quite the prince. And I'm pretty sure there's going to be some sort of like, kind of, you know, big reveal at the end of who he really is. And he's called Dove Prince. And I'm like, come on. So I feel like there's going to be a big reveal with that. And I just really, really liked that. I liked that each of the names was chosen carefully and that I could be a nerd about it afterwards and start to make predictions about what that's going to mean for the future of the series.
Yeah, definitely.
So there we go.
I mean, I'm not going to go into Tolkien too much, but certainly... I'm really not, because, you know, you could have an entire series of podcasts about what Tolkien did with language.
Yes.
But yes, certainly the names that he chose for his characters were either, they either phonically conjured up this image, like, you know, think with the Hobbits, Bilbo and Frodo and Samwise and things, they're sort of like friendly, cosy, warm, rounded names, aren't they? You know, for comfortable creatures. Whereas if you think of, for his elves, things like Galadriel, Legolas, and then for some of the other characters as well, Arwen, Eowyn, they're clearly taken from very, very Celtic roots. And it's even worse if you go into things like the Silmarillion. So as I said, I'm not...
We're not talking about the Silmarillion.
We're not. We could be here forever if we do that. Yes, so I'm not going to go into that, but it's worth bearing in mind. So what this bloke I originally read that essay by was talking about, I don't know. I honestly don't know what books he could have possibly been reading where he's just like, oh, yeah, but, you know, real authors don't give a shit about their character names. And I'm like, what? What books do you actually read, dude?
How dare you? I mean, to be honest, there's only one writer that I know who doesn't care about character names, or at least just picks them from the air, basically. And that's Amelia. That's,
oh, really?
That's our friend Amelia. She's the only person who just goes meh with names. But even she kind of likes it when there are character meaning names in other books, but she just doesn't go for it herself.
No, that's,
and
fair,
she's
that's...
the only one.
Well, I thought you were gonna say someone like James Patterson, but
yeah, I don't think James, but I don't know James Patterson, you know.
No, neither do I. Yeah, so, okay, and I was going to say I haven't really given it that much thought, particularly for Unveiled, but actually I'm sat here thinking, actually I kind of did and didn't realise I had.
Well, can you give us some examples then? What was your unthinking of Unveiled?
My unthinking.
Your subconscious thinking.
My unthinking. Okay, let's start with one that I don't think anyone has actually picked up on this, and they probably wouldn't unless they were a complete nerd on 19th century literature. But Mary Cranford, Mrs. Cranford, the name Cranford is actually the name of a town in Elizabeth Gaskell's famous novel, Cranford, which is a very, very feminist take on 19th century women's relationships, as in almost all the characters in that book are female, and they're all very self-directing. And the main character herself decides that she would rather be a writer than get married, for example.
See, I do know about Cranford. Ah, that's really cool. I didn't make the association, but that's actually really
so
that's really cool.
it was a tiny little Easter egg to say this old lady's not very conventional, for example.
Yeah.
But it wasn't like a big deal.
No.
And then you've got well, I do explain the names in I Hold the Tide because it's something that George Sanders does, kind of. It's his thing, almost like cold reading people, and he's doing it to discomfort M,
yeah,
slightly. And the thing is, she sort of doesn't even really know what her own name means,
yeah,
because it's not a big deal to her. But I got the funniest fan theory. I say funny; it was the most like amazingly thought out that fan theory after this.
Who's it from?
It was from one of my readers in, I think it was Canada.
Okay, all right.
And she just contacted me via my website. saying, okay, that she'd gone and looked at some of the other character names. So obviously Kieran's name means darkness. Lucas's name actually means light. And if Emily means striving, was this a case of me giving a clue to how the entire series is supposed to go? Because Emily was clearly striving between darkness and light.
How dare you!
And I was like, I really want to say yes. I really want to say you're absolutely right. Well done. You're the only person who's got this Easter egg. But the thing is, I'm just not that clever. I picked the names on purpose because of what they meant. And I didn't think any further than that. So if it was totally subconscious. But I was just like, that is like the best fan theory ever. I love it. I really do. I wish I was that clever.
See, I was like that, yeah, Kieran means the little dark one or darkness. And I always kind of liked it because of this, the juxtaposition that you get, especially in Irish and Celtic names. Well, for instance, Vaughan is a Celtic name and it means small. But traditionally, the name Vaughan is given to very tall people.
Yeah.
And you see it in mythology, like Little John. The joke is Little John is anything but little.
Yeah.
And I kind of liked that juxtaposition. Or the little folk, when we all know that fairies are not little.
Yes.
They're not. Sorry. I got fairies in. I got them in.
Well done, Madeline.
Yay! Pound in the fairy jar. where was I going with this? So Kieran is the kind of the juxtaposition, because he's got a darkness within him, but he is kind of the lightness, the light, the sunshine,
yeah,
that Emily needs. Whereas you have Lucas, who is the opposite.
Yeah.
And he's kind of meant to be sort of drawing her in. And the interesting thing is that there does seem to be, you know, there's lightness and there's light with him in the sense that there's this camaraderie and there's this understanding between Lucas and Emmeline. And a sort of enlightenment that she would get with him. But yeah, actually, it's a double-edged sword, and really, it would be darkness. So I liked the juxtaposition of that. This is me putting in my reverse fan theory, which is that it's all about juxtaposition.
I have to say, I was far more falling down on that side of things. I mean, the thing with me and characters is that normally they come in and they sort of name themselves like cats, and then it's really, really hard to unname them or name them something else. But yeah, it has.
Sometimes my characters name themselves, and then I look up the name. I'm like, "Damn,
my subconscious choice is good." Yeah, I'm the same actually. And it's things like, okay, Amy's a really straightforward one because it. I mean, it's a pet form of Amelia, but Amy, in Amy's case, she's almost always called Amy rather than Amelia, and Amy was made popular by Little Women, and it just means, you know, the little beloved one.
Mm.
Which, you know, she is.
She is. She's adorable. Everyone loves her. Oh, fight anyone who hurts Amy.
So, yeah, I have, to a certain extent, played with names a fair bit.
Yeah.
With Unveiled. And mostly because it pleased me to do so, because it's my world and I was enjoying doing it.
Yeah, yeah. And I can totally understand that. Because I've definitely played with names. I mean, there's a lot of playing with names, obviously, in the Hamartia cycle, which I've mentioned before. I mean, the biggest play on names is Feomerha, which no one gets, but I know.
Well,
I know about it.
I got it when I originally read it, and then I thought, no, I must be like, because that's
so obscure.
Well, it wasn't. No, it's a case of, no, you're being too much of a nerd about this. You know, come on, Ironside, drop it. And then you explained it on a podcast, so I was like, no, I was right.
Yeah, so just in case anyone's forgotten or hasn't heard that podcast or is not quite as nerdy as us, Feomerha is a play on Morgana Le Fay, in that it's literally just the name reversed. And Omerha means sea warrior, and Morgana means of the sea. So Feomerha, Like a lot of the Sons of Thessalian characters, the Hamartia Cycle characters, is based off of Arthurian knights. And you see it in several of the others. For instance, Zachary is actually called Tristus. If you've read the second book, you find out his first name is actually Tristus, and that obviously comes from Tristan. Merle is obviously a play on Merlin. and so we go on. There are a lot of little sort of play on words and play of names within the Hamartia cycle, which mostly have to do with the Arthurian legend, as well as name meanings. For instance, Rufus means redhead, and that's not actually in reference to his hair color, but in reference to the fact that he's fireborn.
Burst into flames on occasion.
At any given moment. Startled, burst into flames. It's like, really, just don't jump out at him. He'd not do well in a haunted house. He'd be, you know, one of these, just goes to a theme park, the whole thing sets on fire. Upon reflection, I think it's not a good idea for me to go into these places.
Oh my god, that fan fiction's just taken a startling and interesting new direction.
Excellent. And we also get it in Kestrel, of course. Well, the fact that her name is Kestrel. Also, it's quite, because Emily Lynette also kind of means, it's sparrow, is not sparrow.
It's linnet, which is a little brown songbird that's a little bit like a wren. It's sweet, sweet song, but it's also from a Welsh saint or a Welsh lady in attendance to the goddess Rhiannon.
Yeah, brilliant. I can definitely bring in a bird-eating bird joke next time they cross over.
That'll really piss her off.
It will, and I'm really looking forward to that. but I think the names that I want to talk about are in my children's book, Anise Stowell.
Yep.
And I have mentioned this before, so I'm sorry to any of the listeners who are getting bored of me discussing this topic, but I'm particularly proud of it. Where basically all of the names in Anise Starr are actually just regular nouns. So the main character's called Anise, you have a character called Robin, there's Wolf, Mr. Black, Mr. Bottle, Sage, all of the names are just regular nouns. And there's two reasons for this. The first one is I wanted to give this world a sense that it could be anywhere. It can be translated into any language. These people could live and exist in any world at any time, at any given place. It doesn't exist in our world as it does now, despite the fact that there are some very obvious references. Like, for instance, Robin's surname is Good. His name is Robin Good.
Yeah.
And people were like, oh, like Robin Hood. And I was like, actually, I was thinking of Robin Goodfellow, but yeah, okay. Yeah. Let's go with it. And Anise is called Anise Starr, which I'm not sorry about. I'm not sorry about at all. I like me a good pun. It's not even a pun, but I'm still proud of it. And the other reason I did it is the association that you can get with regular nouns, which are then even more readily available, especially in children's books. You know, for children, they're more readily available. So, you know, I say the word Robin. What do you think of, Jules?
Oh, a little winter bird.
Exactly. Okay, I say the word Anise. What do you think of?
weirdly, I mean, this tea I bought from a herb shop, but presumably because it's got a star Anise in it.
Yeah. And each of these associations are meant to kind of to play into something. Now, one of the associations that I did without really thinking was I have Mr. Black. And yeah, he's just meant to be sort of I am going to just put it in there that his first name is Hart. Is an H-A-R-T, like the deer.
Yes.
But we all know
we all know that's not what you were thinking.
No. Yes, I am going to. I'm going to put that. That's it.
Shame on you. Shame.
I, What's wrong with it? It only gets mentioned once. And we have Mother Nest, for instance, as well. You know, what does the name Mother Nest make you think of? What does the name River make you think of? And it's these small associations which kind of build up and add to the character. For instance, one of the characters is called Huynh. And Huynh is the one character whose name is not an obvious regular noun, because Huynh is actually the Irish and Scottish word for gorse. But I prefer Huynh to gorse, if I'm honest.
Yes.
And Huynh has a very whimsical kind of sound to it. Whereas yeah. Wolf has something regal and territorial. And it's a very, very small and simple thing, but I'm just very proud of it. I'm just rather pleased that using something as simple as regular nouns as names can add that extra level in perhaps a rather obvious way. But I just think that it really adds something to the story. So there you go. I will stand by my... I will stand by my books, no matter what people say.
Okay, to finish off, let's look at, very briefly, let's look at, rather, how names are used to, the tradition of using someone's true name in order to either control them or command them or whatever. And obviously this comes from fairies.
Yay! Well, I think we should probably use one of the first examples, which kind of plays into it but doesn't really mention it fully, which is probably from Rapunzel.
And actually you've got that in a lot of fairy tales, being Snow White, Cinderella. Originally they didn't have names, they were kind of archetypal main characters, if you like, and so they were given descriptive names.
Yeah. Now, Cinderella means cabbage. Why, you may ask, not Cinderella, what am I saying? Rapunzel means cabbage.
I'm glad you couldn't see my face then, because that was... Well, yeah, Rapunzel, it's Ramplin, isn't it, in the story that allegedly the pregnant woman needed to eat. In the very, very original story, her name was Petresanella, which means parsley.
There you go. And it's just the idea that of names actually... being given because they sort of itemized. They made less of a character. The character could then be owned in some ways.
Yeah.
Than if they had their own name. And so this is probably an early example of names being things of ownership, but using names to control people has long been seen, especially in mythology, and as we say, it's something that you do with the fairies. So, pro quo, good tip, guys, if a fairy asks for your name, don't give it. Just say, you may call me, and then maybe give a nickname or something else like that. But don't actually give your name, because the wording of that means very literally they are going to take your name. And if they have your name, they can control you.
Yeah.
And we do see... So next time you guys meet any fairies, this is just heads up for you.
It is something that is used in lots of different books. I've used it myself briefly in Unveiled. A character's true name is a way of, you know, temporarily stopping them.
Yeah.
And it turns up in things like The Bone Season by Samantha Shannon and in various other things, particularly if it's a retelling of fairy tales. Holly Black uses it in her Tithe series, for example.
Yep. And of course it shows up in The Lies of Loch Lomora,
which you've been dying to talk about, so... Have at it.
I won't talk about it too much. But one of the things in The Lies of Loch Lomora is you have the Bonds Mage. And the Bonds Mage use something called grey names. And grey names are what they know and call each other. Whereas their real names they keep obviously to themselves. Because if a mage knows your name, they can control you. So it does mean that when you get to Carthane, where the mages live... people have the most peculiar grey names ever.
Yes.
it's actually quite funny. For instance, the majors tend to go by kind of an occupation, which is funny because it's sort of like, it almost like it goes backwards against what is traditional, in that they go against names which are less formal, and that's actually what protects them, rather than where we had with Rapunzel, a name being not formal allowed a certain ownership. In this case, it's the other way around, which I kind of like.
Yeah.
So you have the falconer. You have the seamstress, who then also becomes Patience. And then you have ones which are a little bit more obscure, like Pelacanthus, and so forth, so yeah. on and so forth. And one of the big things that happens in book one, so small spoilers, guys, so if you're planning on reading it, you might just want to not listen for the next like 2 minutes, is that Loch Lamora, as I've mentioned before, is not his real name. It's actually a grey name that he came up with himself, and this is actually what prevents him from being controlled, unlike Jean Tannen, Jean Estevan Tannen, as his full name is. Sorry, I'm a nerd. who can be controlled. But I'm actually going to stop talking about controlling names and also just talk about the fact that the Lies of Loch Lamora, the Gentleman Bastard Sequence books, also does play with names in another really funny, interesting way, which is that, first of all, Loch is very obviously named after a video game character, and Scott Lynch has admitted this. second of all, of the main crew at the beginning, it's very clear that this is a kind of a shadow version of Robin Hood, in that you don't have Little John, you have Jean. And I don't know how you could be more obvious than that. And it's names with alliteration. Loch Lamora, Robin Hood, and he's called the Thorn of Camor. Again, we have that association with nature as well. And the whole premise, the taking from the rich and giving to the poor, which is what people believe the Thorn of Camor does. It isn't. Loch Lamora steals from the rich and keeps it. Despite the fact they have so much money, they don't know what to do with. Which is the bit that really amuses me. They're like, well, why do we keep stealing? They just keep doing it.
It's what we do.
It's what we do. We literally have so much money, we can't spend any of it. So, for instance, you get Bug, the character Bug, who's very reminiscent of Much.
Yeah.
And I just really, really like that. In that these names are, apart from Jean, the names are nowhere similar. And yet they seem to kind of fit within the same sort of box. They definitely tick the familiarity, which I really, really rather like.
Yeah, definitely.
And I think we've run out of time.
That brings us to the end, yeah.
Yeah. Well, before we go, it is time for our Dissecting Dragons recommendation of the week. And I did mention it earlier, but I am going to really recommend everybody check out The Dragon Prince. I know you may find the animation a little jarring because it's definitely a little bit different, but stick with it. Storytelling is good. I can definitely see this being a new sort of like fan favorite of people. So highly recommended. Do go and check it out. It is on Netflix. Second season hasn't been confirmed yet, but hey, if enough people watch it, you know what? Fingers crossed. And on that note, guys, we'll say thanks very much for listening, and we'll catch you guys next week.
Yep, thanks and goodbye.
Bye!
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note that no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.